time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the hex maze, and the anechoic chamber. We are the show that finds the ecstasy in your exobiology, the candy in your cardiology, the chronic joy in your geochronology, the crack in your crystallography.
What's with all the drug references this time?
Drug references, what are you talking about?
Drug reference, you've got ecstasy, you've got crack.
Crack? Well, no, that's crack in the Irish sense. C-R-A-I-C. Crack like at a good time. You know, Irish slang.
Goodness.
You got drugs on the mind, Matt.
I always do. I'm a chemist.
All right. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. First up, as always, the Edison to my Tesla, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College, Matt Smith. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Edison voice. So I'm the thief. You are the charlatan.
You are the thief. I deliberately had a kind of a debate because Tesla, the name is kind of tainted these days because of Elon.
Yeah.
But this is Nikola Tesla, right? You are Thomas Edison. So I clearly cast you as the thief.
Well, hello, nice people.
And our guest host today, whose schedule just opened up, is Jimmy Kimmel. No, not Jimmy Kimmel. But dare I say, just as entertaining, longtime Tulsa resident, humorist, author, and commentator straight from his new home in Portugal, Barry Friedman. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Good to be here. And again, people can't see it, obviously, but I'm glad you didn't spend a lot of money decorating the set.
it's all tripped out really, in gold, the gold trimmings, and it looks like the Oval Office these days. So,
and no humorist who is really humorous would ever be caught dead, be called a humorous. So just so you know, in the future, if we do this again, it's like a mirth maker.
Yeah. Well, people always describe Mark Twain as a humorist, and so that's high praise. That's high company, right?
Yeah.
The elite company. So you're coming to us from Portugal. So why did you move to Portugal? Do you have formal refugee status there? Are you registered with UNHCR?
That's really good. No, the reason Portugal is it just seemed like a good time to come. The opportunity was there, the adventure was there, and they let you in the country pretty easily here in Portugal. At least they did. Okay. And of course, the fourth thing was just what's happening to America. I can't really gloss over that.
You're part of the brain drain that we've been experiencing here. We've lost one of our brains, and it's you.
Which is certainly happening among the scientific community. We certainly see lots of people that are looking for graduate schools elsewhere and leaving programs in the U.S. and being excluded, harassed and just excluded. They're failing to get student visas and so on. So they're going other places other than the U.S. So there's certainly a brain drain going on. You're not exactly a scientist, Barry. You want to make sure to say that you have no scientific credentials. You do actually have a credit here to your name, or a line on your CV, which is that you write for the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, their trade journal, The Explorer. So tell us about geology and all of its wonders.
Well, I know that if you have dirt, for instance, and you pour water on it, you'll get mud. That's really what I know about.
So how did you get this gig writing for The Explorer?
34 years ago, a good friend of mine, Vern Stefanik, was the editor of the magazine. He thought and was under the impression I could write. And so he said, let's just see if we can do this. And for 30, 40 years, they've been throwing me stories and I've been handling them. And again, it's, you know, if you can write or you know about writing, you can put anything together with enough information. And these guys, you scientists do know your stuff. And so if you send me it and I can copy and paste it into my own document, it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. Once in a while, the editor will call me and say, we're not quite sure what you were doing with this article. Go, really? Just this one?
So they're not going to have you host the live geology hour. Is that what you're saying on television or something?
No, Sometimes I will have a scientist or a professor ask me if I'm going to go to Zagreb to cover the meeting. Yeah, maybe not this year. It's to show you how much I don't know about science is in 11th grade in New York, they had the New York State Regents. And you had to pass the Regents to move on to the next grade. Well, somebody broke into the Regents headquarters in Albany, New York, stole copies of the Regents, and they were afraid they were disseminated all over the state. So they canceled the Regents. So you could just move on to 12th grade, which was good because on my practice Regents, I kid you not, my practice physics or chemistry Regents, can't remember exactly which one, I got a 5.
Out of 100.
I got the first question right. I got the next 19 wrong. So I know very little about geology. Just quickly here, the only thing I actually knew about geology was there was a great line from my favorite writer, Joan Didion, whose parents were geologists. Mm-hmm. And she wrote this line that California was wonderful because in California, things had better work out because you got the sense if they didn't, you're out of luck because there in California, we ran out of continent. Which I thought was a great line. And I put that in a story. And that line they took out of the story because apparently nobody knew who Joan Didion was except me.
So, you found a new continent, though. You ran out of continent and then you found a whole new one, right?
Yeah. So anyway, but I still have this special affection for Tulsa. And I, you know, people make fun of it. I make fun of it. But, you know, say what you want about Oklahoma, but there's always plenty of parking.
Yeah, we have in common a particular location in Tulsa that we frequent. I know that you have your very own table at New York Bagel Company on Brookside, and I am there at New York Bagel like 3 or 4 times a week. I saw you there occasionally, but you were sitting at your table, so you had a nameplate by you. So I was like, oh, that must be very free.
Have you sat at the table?
I always felt like it wasn't appropriate for me to sit at that table. I mean, like, that's your table. I see other people doing it, but I look askance at them. I try to shame them. I give them dirty glares. You're not Barry Friedman. Why are you sitting there?
So. You tell them next time you go that I allow you to sit at the table. Okay. just so you know, you have my permission to sit at the table. I'm glad the name
is anyone or just Brian?
Just me.
Just Brian.
Just me.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
All right. Well, I think we can probably move on to some headlines. What do you think?
Sure. Get it.
First up, we have the headlines. In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the sciencey headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. Let's go to Mars. How about Mars?
I like Mars. Excellent. Actually, I don't. Mars is a dead, dumb planet.
Oh my gosh, your anti-Mars bias is just overwhelming.
All right, tell us about Mars. What new things have we found?
Martians. We have found Martians, potentially. The Perseverance rover, which landed in 2021. This is the one that we had the very dramatic views of its parachuting down to the surface. This is the one that has the little drill so that it can go around and it can drill into the rocks and it can take a sample and it can kind of package up that sample as well, too. So they are hoping at some point to be able to collect some of these samples and bring them back to the Earth so that we can actually get our hands on them here. But in the meantime, it can do a lot of experiments on this stuff actually on site there and beam the data back to us. And they have found possible evidence of not living right now, but ancient Martian life. And Matt, do you know what this Martian life was wearing when it was discovered?
I hope it's a bow tie.
A bow tie, a tuxedo, a pashmina shawl. Nope. I'm afraid not. It has arrived dressed like Peg Bundy, that is wearing leopard print. So the tackiest way possible for Martian life to announce itself. My apologies to everybody who is a leopard print enthusiast out there. What can I say? I am just an incredible snob. The findings were reported in a recent article in Nature. This article was titled Redox-Driven Mineral and Organic Associations in Jezero Crater, Mars by Hurwitz et al. So they really know how to write a title to catch people's interest.
Don't
they? I mean, if you don't hear redox-driven mineral and organic associations and think, oh my gosh, Martian life, then I don't know. I don't know if you read the English language. So what they found was with these really interesting rock formations that have, again, the appearance of leopard print, right? There are these sort of spots scattered about. The spots are inclusions of this ferrous iron phosphates and iron sulfides, these reduced forms of iron phosphates and iron sulfide, and that in association with organic molecules. So what they think has happened here is that this may have been caused by microbial life that's kind of consuming the organic stuff and producing the iron phosphates and sulfides as kind of reduced byproducts of their metabolism.
So they found leopard print Martian bacteria poop.
That's right, exactly.
Wonderful.
So that's what they found. Of course, we can't eliminate every other possibility. There are ways that don't involve life that could form these sorts of things. But they've eliminated many of the likeliest non-living pathways to get what they have observed here. So
this is what the paper discussed, wasn't it? Yeah. They were trying to replicate could these compounds have been made in this shape by a non-biological route?
Right. And they said, so like if it's very high temperatures, then there are non-living processes that would produce it. But they think it was produced at low temperature. It was really acidic environment, and they think there are non-living pathways that could produce it, but they don't think it was very acidic.
Now, where was this on Mars?
This is in the Jezero crater, right? So this is where the Perseverance rover has been exploring for the past several years. It's been moving around. This was, we think, many billions of years ago, this was a lake on Mars. And this area where this was found was actually like a stream flowing into the lake. And so someplace that's very hospitable to life that you would expect life to be. And in fact, that's why they were there. They were just searching randomly over the surface of Mars. They had picked a spot. Hey, you know, if there are signs of life, it's probably going to be here. So
probably in the water. Life here began in the water, didn't it?
Are you excited by the discovery of Martians, Barry?
Well, I really want to be there, the fly on the wall, when the scientists bring that to a venture capitalist and say, hey, we have the trillions now. We need to go back to Mars. We found poop that has leprous skin. They're going to go, get us the checkbook. Say no more.
Right? The possibilities, the market possibilities, once we recover the Martian poop.
Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, like ground up rhinoceros horn. It was a commodity.
That's right.
I think ground up Martian leopard poop would be great.
What we need to do is develop some sort of myth. We need to spread rumors about it having, you know, effects on your potency as a man, or it cures cancer. There's got to be a certain number of people that will believe that, and then you could sell them Martian poop. You could probably sell them anything and tell them that it's Martian poop as well too.
That's so true. I guess you're right here. Take the Martian poop, and then you don't have to get your vaccines.
That's right.
You can't lie about Martian poop. If they say it's Martian poop, they have laws against that. You can't just say it's Martian poop if it's not.
Everybody's following the law these days too. That's what I so appreciate about modern society. We're just kind of waiting now to see if we find other examples of this. I'm not real confident that we are going to retrieve those samples anytime soon, but what we have so far is pretty interesting, and maybe the rover will be able to find other confirming evidence.
Maybe Matt Damon can pick them up the next time he's over there.
Yeah, right.
You know what would help, though? Would help future Mars exploration is if the Chinese or the Indians or the Russians say they want to go. We'll have somebody to beat.
That's right.
But without any competition, we're not going back.
Yeah. The Chinese space program in particular has made quite a lot of progress over the last decade or so. And but the thing is that the competition has to be focused on, you know, a square-jawed American astronaut conquering the universe. It can't be just some little robot that's tootling about. That's the problem.
You're saying we should have given the Curiosity rover a chin.
That's right. We should have given it a chin.
A strong chin, a nice jawline.
Yeah.
So it would also serve us right, really serve us right, if one of these scientists we throw out at the University of Michigan or MIT goes back home to China and develops their science program, and they beat us just because we had them. And we threw them out. It would serve us right.
I mean, that's exactly what Nazi Germany did to itself, right? Kicked out all of its scientists. They came here to America, and
there's a great Mort Sahl joke about that. That Wernher von Braun came over here, was our great scientist, and he wrote a book, "I Aim for the Stars," and Sahl said, "Yeah, but sometimes I hit London."
Yeah, It's an interesting and tense relationship between the U.S. and Wernher von Braun, certainly. All right, next up, we have ant queens producing sons of two distinct species. And frankly, this is very confusing, and I regret a little bit picking it up as one of our headlines.
I mean, from the title, it sounds like an episode of Maury.
It's just confusing on so many levels. I mean, ant reproduction already is confusing to begin with. And then this particular story makes it even more confusing. Honestly, I just am very, very peeved with nature in general. Why does everything have to be so damn complicated all the time? It's exhausting. I mean, especially in biology, you can't say anything without there being an exception. You could say, hey, plants do photosynthesis. Well, mostly, but then they have parasitic plants that have lost their chlorophyll, ghost plants and things. Hey, sharks are cold-blooded predators. Hey, except for the largest, you know, the largest shark, which is the whale shark, which is a filter feeder. But honestly, I thought that I was safe saying, well, a species produces other individuals of its species, right? Species reproduce themselves.
They produce, I feel like that should be a given.
But recent work published in Nature on a species, it's actually in your backyard, Barry. This is Mesor ibericus. This is a Iberian harvester ant. So we'll need you to go outside and try to collect some samples of this for us. So just a little bit of background here. When we think about the hymenopterans, and that's ants, bees, and wasps, those things have what's called haplodiploid sex determination, which means that if you get a fertilized egg, it becomes a female. Okay, it becomes either a female worker or a female reproductive. And then if you have an unfertilized egg, it becomes a male. So males are just developing from unfertilized eggs, and they are haploid. That means they have only one copy. They only have only the copy of the genetic information from their mother. And some species do really weird things, like they will produce hybrid workers with sperm from another species, right? So they will mate with another male, and they'll produce females that are workers that don't reproduce. So it's like they're, you know, kind of parasitizing the other species, okay? And then we've got this situation with Mesor ibericus, right? And what it'll do, it will fertilize eggs with sperm from this other species, M. structor, right? So it'll fertilize the eggs with the sperm from that other species, right? And produce, again, hybrid workers that are kind of dead ends, and that will just work for that queen and so on, but they don't reproduce or anything. But then they discover they do this other weird thing, which is that they will fertilize an egg with the sperm from M. structor, and then the queen will eliminate its own genes from that egg, and that egg will develop into a male of M. structor. I don't know if you followed that at all, but it's insanely complicated, and it's insanely bizarre, and you just want to say, why? Why are you doing this? What is the purpose of this?
So it takes in the sperm from the other species.
It takes in the sperm from the other species.
And then only actually produces an offspring from that sperm, even though like it joined and then it unjoined it.
Well, it joined and formed a fertilized egg, which would then have two copies of the genome, but it eliminates its own copy of the genome to leave just the male's genome in there, which then develops into a new male out of that, but now as an egg with only one copy of the genome in it. But that copy of the genome is from the other species. And so we're producing males of the other species for some reason that I don't understand.
Frankly. Are these a symbiotic species? Do they hang out together?
No, I mean, it's not a symbiosis, right? I mean, it's just bizarre. And I don't really know what the rationale is for. I don't know why it happens. I mean, when you're using the sperm to fertilize the eggs and make workers that then do your bidding, the workers don't reproduce themselves, so that's a dead end. So that's just kind of taking advantage of the other species. But why are you producing males of this other species? It's like they've become kind of a hybrid species or something. I mean, it's really weird, and I'm not sure I have even a good hypothesis for why this is happening. It's very interesting. I hope that they shed light on it in the future. Did you follow any of that, Barry, or was that just?
Yeah, clearly there's low. It's sperm envy. It's low self-worth of your own sperm. I think the first thing they teach you in any psychoanalysis is to, embrace your sperm, and this clearly hasn't. And so this is the result.
I've been in therapy before, Barry, and honestly, nobody has ever told me to embrace my sperm. That phrase has never been uttered in my presence until this very moment.
You embrace your sperm, and then when you embrace your sperm, when other sperm comes, you don't go, "Oh, that sperm is better. My sperm is fine." Empower your own sperm. We've been through this before. Actually, we haven't. But if we had, we would a good place to review. If you have sperm, if you're listening, embrace it. Don't mock it. Don't feel jealousy of other people's sperm. They have sperm, you have sperm. No sperm is better than other sperm. All sperm is fine.
Every sperm is sacred, yeah, right?
All sperm matters. We went from penis envy to sperm envy. You should just follow the path. It's clear. It's a good thing I'm here and straighten this out for you.
We're very grateful.
Thanks. All right. So you guys are asking for more hymenopteran news. Is that what I'm hearing from both of you? Is that you want more hymenopteran news?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can't get enough of a hymenoptera.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, there seems to be a never-ending stream of hornets invading our country, Matt. No doubt you've noticed. Do you remember the murder hornets from a few years ago?
I do remember the murder hornets. Weren't we not supposed to call them murder hornets? I can't remember why.
I was kind of partial to the name murder hornet. It has a lot of punch to it. I suppose it is a little bit inaccurate if you think it means the murder hornets are going around murdering human beings. They were actually mostly murdering honeybees. So these are the biggest hornets out there. They're about 1.5 to 2 inches in length. They're pretty big. They kind of fill up your hand if you put them in the palm of your hand.
I'm not going to do that.
They're about the size of, around here we have the cicada killer wasp. These cicada killers are not hornets, but they are a wasp about the size of the murder hornets, the big ones. Have you ever seen those, Barry, around here, the big giant yellow and black wasps that hunt cicadas? You seen those?
That's why I moved.
Well, the good news is you don't need to be worried about cicada killer wasps. They are huge wasps, but they're solitary wasps. They are dangerous to cicadas, and they are digging little burrows in the ground, and they put the cicada in there, and they lay their babies on it, and the babies develop eating on that cicada. You also don't have to worry about the murder hornet either, though. Now, murder hornets, again, were mostly just a threat to honeybees, not to us, but they've been eradicated. They came in 2019, and then December 2024, we declared the murder hornet was gone from North America.
What a relief. How did we do that? How did we get rid of them?
Well, we did get rid of them because they never were very extensive. And so basically, we just tracked down all the colonies and eliminated them very quickly. So they never really got established.
So we waged war on the murder hornets.
We waged war on the murder hornets and we got rid of them. And they were really kind of only up in the Pacific Northwest. But don't relax too much because we have another hornet that has come in. This is the Asian hornet. The other was the giant Asian hornet, the murder hornet. This one is the Asian hornet. It's a little bit smaller. And it's sometimes called the yellow-legged hornet. This is Vespa volutina. And it has been reported now in the U.S. Just the murder hornet was exiting. We have in Georgia and now South Carolina, we have colonies of this new hornet that have been established. And we have the same problem with that, which is that they attack honeybee colonies. They get together and they kind of do a sortie and they attack a bee colony and they just start decapitating all the bees. So it's pretty gruesome. They're actually much more of a threat to you though, Barry, right? Again, I did not purposely base this all on your new home, but this is a species that's actually been invasive in Europe for much longer. So it is all over Southern Europe, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, kind of all over Southern Europe. But now it's kind of creeping into the UK as well, too. So they're trying to control it in the UK. We're obviously trying to control it here. The new research that I have here for you, just apart from just trying to stress everybody out, is this interesting bit of research that was published last month. It is Asian hornets have a unique sound, and that could be the key to controlling their spread. So this is work that's been done at Southampton University in the UK. Sophie Gray and her advisors, she's a graduate student in acoustic engineering, has discovered that there are particular frequencies produced by these different species, particular frequencies of sound, and they are now using those frequencies of sound to detect colonies. Honeybees produce sound at 250 hertz. The European hornets, those native hornets there in Europe, produce sound at 110 hertz.
But with the exchange, though, that's about the same. Really?
Right. Sure. That's right. The exchange rate. What is the sound exchange rate, right, of Euro hertz to American hertz, the dollar hertz. So 125, 110, 250. So if you can find the right frequency, something buzzing at the right frequency, then it's probably the hornet that you want to destroy. So
there's actually another way of dealing with this, right? That you know, if you go outside and deal with nature, nature can kill you.
Yeah.
If nature comes into your house inside, you can kill whatever enters your house. And as long as we remember those two certainties, I think we'll all be a lot better. You go outside, you can be destroyed because it's theirs.
Yeah.
Right? It's theirs. The wasps don't have to kowtow to you because you're exploring. By the same token, if the wasp comes in the house, you can have a discussion, go to the wasp. Hey, listen, I realize you have as much right to this universe as I do, but this is my kitchen. Dead.
What about the patio? I mean,
interesting. That's a very good point. I think if it's a covered patio, it's yours. Uncovered, it's theirs. It's a very good point. Yeah.
We need as diplomats, right? We need a treaty. We need a Treaty of Madrid or Treaty of Lisbon, right? But you can head that delegation to the Hornets, come up with an arrangement, negotiate all the patio issues, public parks,
It's theirs. Awning, theirs. Enclosed in porch, yours. We can establish this and keep everybody safe. But no, we have to go to the river. We have to go to the land. We have to drink in nature. We have to do whatever. Why? It's theirs. They don't owe us anything.
But we are protecting the delicate honeybees from these evil invaders. We're protecting one part of nature from another part of nature. So
let them deal with it. Do they help us with the North Koreans? No. I think a little reciprocity is what we need here. Otherwise, let them work it out. Like children, you let them work it out. Let the bees work it out.
We do get more, we have more economic trade with the bees than we do with North Korea, actually, though. So we get the honey from the bees.
There we go. They're one of our trade partners.
All right. Excellent. So for the next headline, I'm going to hand this off to Matt because it is more of a Matt thing.
More of a chemistry physics sort of
thing. He is a fusion enthusiast.
I am. Absolutely. So fusion power is so neat. And there have been recent advances in room temperature desktop fusion reactors. So look, not all fusion reactors are the size of a building. You know, like the tokamaks and the stellarators are massive, massive things. Mm-hmm. We can actually build smaller ones, just using a different method. So the difficulty in getting nuclear fusion to work is that nuclei just don't like each other at all. Yeah. They're all positively charged. And so if you try to like shoot them at each other, just that little bit of repulsion will deflect them just barely enough. And that's all it takes for them not to hit. So getting two nuclei to actually hit and fuse is incredibly difficult. Nature has its own way of solving that problem. Stars, friggin' huge. And so they use massive amounts of pressure. If they crush the core enough, then those atoms in the middle, right, they're eventually going to come together. We can't generate those kinds of pressure here planet side. I mean, we can when we go for the inertial confinement method of doing fusion power. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's more of a fusion bomb. And that's less fun, I think. That's just not my personal thing.
And last time you talked about using lasers
and
inertial confinement.
That was for inertial confinement, yeah. Okay. So we are working on ways of using that for power generation. Okay. And people who follow fusion energy are more familiar with magnetic
confinement. The millions of people.
Millions and millions of people.
Who hang on every fusion headline.
The magnetic confinement is where you have the little donut-shaped chambers, the tokamaks and the stellarators that are kind of that kind of donut
shape. Torus
shape, yes. Or bagel shape, you too.
Bagel shape.
You all were talking about bagel earlier.
So it's a bagel. That's the bagel-shaped fusion.
This is
cold fusion.
Which
I know was debunked decades ago.
Yes, well, this is not cold fusion and has not been debunked because it works.
Okay, all right.
This is called lattice confinement, not lettuce confinement.
Lattice confinement.
Right. So lattice confinement is a third type, and it's where our story today takes us. It is not high pressure, and it is hot and high temperature. Mm-hmm. So how does it work?
It's cold fusion.
It's not cold fusion. Stop it. It's not cold fusion.
It's not hot fusion. So it's not cold. It's lukewarm fusion.
Let's go with that. Room temperature fusion.
Room temperature.
It's not cold. Okay. It's not cold.
All right.
It's room temperature.
I gotcha.
No, lattice confinement is the you hold them, I'll punch sort of method of getting two nuclei to merge. You know, it's the idea where if we hold one of them immobilized, then the other one that shoots at it has an easier target to hit. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the idea with it. So what happens is you have deuterium atoms are adsorbed, so they're like just stuck on the side of the surface of a metal. In this case, it's palladium, while other deuterium atoms are fired at them from a particle accelerator. Some of them are held in place on the surface of the metal. Mm-hmm. We shoot other things at them. Yeah, so the idea being that all the deuterium ions are being shot by the particle accelerator mm-hmm. at the palladium source mm-hmm. will either stick to the palladium because they didn't hit a deuterium, mm-hmm. or they'll hit a deuterium, in which yeah. case they will, you know, fuse, hopefully, right. we hope. So and that is lattice confinement.
And so does that net you energy?
And as with most things in fusion, achieving fusion is no longer the hurdle. Mm-hmm. We have found ways of achieving fusion. Right now, the hurdle is, can we do it in a way that actually produces energy?
Well, that was my question. I said, does it net energy? So it doesn't net energy. The lattice thing doesn't.
Not yet. So anyway, as reported in Nature this August, fine folks at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, they took this process of lattice confinement to the next level by using a thing called, it sounds like sorcery, electrochemical loading. Managing to stuff more deuterium ions into the palladium than were supposed to be there by just adsorbing from the surface. Okay. And they did this by basically doing electrolysis on the backside. Okay. So on one side of the palladium, you've got the particle beam from the normal lattice confinement experiment. Yeah. On the other side, you have an electrolytic cell, which is splitting deuterated water. So water where the hydrogens are deuterium atoms instead of hydrogens. I know it sounds made up. Deuterated water.
You made that up right now.
You wish. You wish. So that means that the deuterium ions are absorbing through the palladium on one end and adsorbing on the other. Okay. And it gives you a boost to the efficiency and the fusion reaction. They've managed to increase the efficiency, the rate of the fusion reaction by lattice confinement by 15%, okay. which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but everything in fusion power right now is about efficiency.
Again, the question I'm going to ask you is, when am I going to be able to heat up my baked potato with your little fusion reactor?
I mean,
when am I going to be able to cook my lean cuisine, right?
I think that would be great. That's if what you I'm want gonna, to that's... cook your lean cuisine using neutron radiation rather than microwave radiation.
Okay.
You just put it right into the machine. Because this is...
But that wouldn't be technically fusion.
Lattice, right? The experiment, I saw pictures of this thing at the University of British Columbia. They had pictures of this guy standing next to it. It would fit on this table.
Okay. Was he holding a lean cuisine?
He was not holding a lean cuisine, no.
All right.
Unfortunately not.
Do you have any thoughts on fusion, Barry?
Just, I'm with you on the microwave, which apparently it's bad for you when you put plastic in there. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it depends on the kind of plastic.
It depends, yeah, the plastics, yeah. It's just because the plastics are breaking down. But aren't we, like, mostly microplastics at this point anyways?
Yeah.
I eat so many chips, I'm at least 40% chip by mass, but I think I'm also at 40% microplastic.
You know the microwave thing, the guy actually discovered the microwave, his name escapes me right now, but he discovered it because he was in the laboratory and he had, like, a candy bar in his pockets and the candy bar melted. When he was standing next to the microwave, he's like, "Hey, yeah, I can heat up food with this." And so, I think what I'm going to advocate for here is all fusion scientists to carry lean cuisines and candy bars around with them. And when those cook spontaneously, we'll know that they've achieved their goal of cooking. We hit the threshold. Okay, that's it for the headlines. Up next, we need to take care of last episode's sound science puzzler. Here it is again for your consideration. Was last episode's sound science puzzler. Matt, did you know what this one was?
It was not Jiffy Pop.
It was not Jiffy Pop. It was not tapping. Nobody was tapping.
No, no, no. This is the sound of a Geiger counter.
Geiger counter. Yes, it very is. Good. What does a Geiger counter do?
It detects radiation.
Okay, excellent.
Nuclear radiation.
We did actually get several right answers to this one.
So, excellent. Good job, viewers.
Congratulations, viewers. Listeners.
Congratulations. Good job, listeners.
Congratulations to our listeners out there. We'll be contacting you if you got the correct answer, contacting you about your prize, which will be a keychain, a Yakety Science keychain. So it's a hot property. So cherish it always. Up later in the show, we'll have a new sound science puzzler for you.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's.
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up one of the shiniest elements, aluminum, atomic number 13.
Yep, aluminum. Okay, obviously the first thing we should discuss is the name. Is it aluminum or aluminium?
Oh, that's right. We were supposed to do this from a British pub, weren't we?
That's right. I'm supposed to record this at the Green Dragon or something.
That's right.
Aluminium, my dears. Yeah. Aluminium is actually the preferred name by IUPAC. That's the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. That's our naming board, who does all the naming nomenclature rules for everything. And the British Commonwealth and various other countries. Aluminum is the American English version that's used mostly just in
America
and Canada. But both derive from the word alumen, which is the Latin term for alum. Alum is actually ancient mineral, first described by the Greek historian Herodotus, also by the Roman historian Pliny the Elder. Alum is a dye fixative.
Dye your toga purple.
Absolutely, and you don't want it to wash out. It's very important. So if you're dyeing your toga purple, you are royalty anyway.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. Also, it exists as alumina, which is aluminum oxide, which you may more recognize as its gemstone, its corundum.
Okay.
Rubies, sapphires are aluminum oxide.
What was the word you used? Corundum?
Corundum. As an ore, it's bauxite. As a gem, it is corundum.
Okay.
Which, the nomenclature for corundum is so weird. Rubies are red. Mm-hmm. Literally every other corundum in every other color is a sapphire. This is weird.
So they're all corundums, but
they're
then
all
they have different names depending on
their color. On their color. If they're red, rubies get their red color from chromium atoms.
And that's what compound? It's aluminum.
It's aluminum oxide with impurities. It's the impurities.
Impurities
aluminum oxide on its own is colorless. We're all familiar with aluminum. We see aluminum foil. We see aluminum, you know, in our construction and our devices and having aluminum casings for our phones. Aluminum is a low density. It's soft. It's easily machined and cast. It's ductile and malleable, extrudable. There's a reason that we use aluminum for all sorts of applications, including blocking signals from the Illuminati.
Okay.
Obviously.
Awesome. Yes.
The story.
That's the aluminum foil hat.
The aluminum.
People say tin foil hat, but it's almost always an aluminum foil hat.
It's been aluminum foil since 1910.
That's right.
The tin foil, they stopped using tin. Okay, so stop calling it tin foil.
The best thing about aluminum foil is saran wrap. You know, it's impossible to get out of the container, wax paper doesn't adhere.
Yeah.
Aluminum foil adheres to surfaces. That's the only reason we need it.
Yeah. Well, it's great for campfire cooking too. You can wrap up your corn and your potatoes or whatever, just toss them into the fire and then pull them out later.
Absolutely wonderful. Yeah. And don't forget to recycle your aluminum. It costs the energy cost of recycling aluminum is 5% reducing it from the bauxite.
And the mining of bauxite is very environmentally.
Oh yeah. So please recycle. Earnest efforts to isolate whatever weird metal was inside alum and alumina and corundum and bauxite started in the Renaissance in the 1500s and continued with no success for 300 years. Everyone was trying to figure out what is in this compound here. It's a metal. We don't know what it is. Even our boy, Antoine Lavoisier.
Yeah, couldn't figure it out.
He couldn't figure it out. All he could do is conclude that there is a metal in there with such an affinity for oxygen that it could not be isolated by current means. And he was right, actually. Aluminum is extremely reactive. Have you touched aluminum? Have you felt aluminum?
I've touched an aluminum can.
Yes. You are a liar. You have never, ever in your life touched aluminum.
Is it covered in a film?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Aluminum will react extremely quickly, instantly almost, with oxygen in the air to form a passivation layer, a layer of rust. People say
and
that...
that's what you're touching?
That's actually what you're touching. So it gets this reputation. People say, oh yeah, aluminum doesn't rust. Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. It rusts. Mm-hmm. It's just, it rusts in a way that protects the aluminum from further oxidation. Mm-hmm. Unlike iron, which rusts in a way that's like flakes away and is destructive overall.
My fun fact about aluminum is that it is the most commonly used adjuvant. Do you know what an adjuvant is, Matt?
Oh yeah. Like a counselor, an attorney.
No, that's not it. An adjuvant is something that you put in with the vaccine to increase the response of the immune system. Do you know, just this is an aside here, but this is adjuvant history. Adjuvants were discovered by Gaston Ramon. And do you know what the first adjuvant was? First effective adjuvant?
It's probably something like cocaine or something.
No, it's not cocaine. It's tapioca. So tapioca was the first adjuvant. So they first were putting tapioca into the injection sites. So this is, of course, the kind of starchy stuff that comes out of cassava manioc. It's the stuff in boba tea.
That's what I'm thinking of, tapioca pudding.
Tapioca pudding, that's what it is, right? So anyway, he found that this worked. So I just think it's funny that they were shoving tapioca into their vaccines back in the 1920s when they first started discovering this.
It's so bizarre.
That's my fun fact.
Here's the big question about aluminum, which you guys have not even addressed. One of the reasons I did the show. Right? Here's the question. Lately, I've been hearing you do not wrap up hamburger meat in aluminum foil. Why is that?
I don't know. You know?
I remember seeing something about it wasn't just the aluminum, but if you use aluminum foil to cover a steel baking dish and it has and you're using that with like a tomato bake, like a lasagna. Mm-hmm. People do this with lasagna, what they're talking about.
Right.
Where then there actually is an electrochemical potential between the steel and the aluminum, and it ends up dissolving some of the aluminum into your food. Mm-hmm. And you get aluminum compounds.
And then
there.
Your vaccines work better.
Right. That's what comes to mind.
Why wasn't this the lead? That's what we need to know. That's what your listeners want to know.
Well, this is why you're here, Barry.
Yeah.
To keep us in line.
We have leakage into the lasagna. Lasagna leakage. That's the headline for the show. What are you guys talking about with vaccines and names and fusion? Lasagna leakage.
It's the lasagna.
To be fair, I tried to steer us to the lean cuisine angle.
That's true. You kept on talking about lean cuisine. So.
You did.
And here I am talking about names and recycling.
This is why the lean cuisine is not wrapped up in aluminum.
Yeah.
That's right. So are you ready to talk about discovery then? So it was actually discovered twice. The first discovery was finally in 1824, a Danish physicist. This is Hans Christian Ørsted. Ørsted did an experiment with aluminum chloride and an amalgam of potassium. When I say amalgam, what do you think? It's like smushed up. It's like a blend of something. Yeah, in chemistry, an amalgam is specifically a mixture of mercury. He produced aluminum, but was apparently impure. He made only a potassium aluminum alloy and apparently was deemed unfit. So he just gives up on the project. You know, aluminum can just F off. So years later, his friend, Friedrich Wöhler, refined his technique. He gets credit for actually discovering it. Honestly, it was a joint effort. I think we can say it's a joint effort.
Are we close to a rating here? Do we have other fun facts?
I have one more question for you two scientists, though. This is very important. Why is it when you bite into aluminum foil, it hurts like a mother?
It only hurts you if you have fillings.
Okay, that's it? Because I got rid of my fillings. All right, so I'm good now?
Yeah, you should be fine. Go bite that.
What does it do? Create a little...
I think because you have aluminum foil and when you have metal fillings.
Yeah.
Mercury fillings, right. Mercury fillings, all right.
Yeah, mercury fillings, yeah, because you have... Okay. That's also an amalgam.
So if
you don't have metal fillings, bite it all you want.
We have to take care of the rating here. So,
that's true.
What's your rating, Matt?
I feel very strongly about aluminum. I like it very much. Aluminum.
So you're going to give it 3 stars, right?
No. I feel like there's nothing wrong with aluminum, and I like an element that's really hard to figure out. Uh-huh. You know, and it didn't murder anyone like fluorine. Mm-hmm. fluorine murdered a whole bunch of its would-be discoverers. So I just like that it was playing hard to get. And who doesn't love aluminum foil? 5 stars for me. I love aluminum.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well,
now aluminum sucks.
1 star.
One star aluminum.
5 stars.
I'm giving Reynolds Wrap a 5. I'm giving the generic a 3.
So we'll average yours to 4. I'm quite conflicted about aluminum. I mean, it's an effective adjuvant and so makes our vaccines better. It is great for cooking, right? I've never knowingly encountered the problem of aluminum dissolving into my food. It is certainly convenient. I do hate the plastic wrap. I guess I'll give it a 4 stars.
All right, good. All right, so
we have to think about the environmental cost of mining it as well too, but then it is easily recycled. I mean, I just, honestly, I'm all over the place on aluminum.
All right, so that is a 4 1/3 star.
Yeah.
That's what we got.
That's the final word on aluminum. Excellent. Thank you, Matt. Next up, we have, what's element number 14?
Silicon.
Silica. Oh, that's a good one. Silicon chips. All right. So next time on Yakety Science.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. All right, that's it. Let's have it one more time, just for good measure. All right, that's it. Anybody have any ideas?
Any thoughts, Barry?
Any thoughts? It sounds like the Death Star is destroying.
Oh, no, that's the intro to the Stevie Nicks concert.
It's a laser show from the 70s.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, if you think that's it, then send that answer to yakityscience@gmail.com. Make sure to include your name, a good phone number to reach you, social security number, date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of those are much appreciated. Submit those with your answers. We will reveal the answer to this puzzler next time on Yakety Science. Well, that is it for this very special episode of Yakety Science. Thank you for joining us, Barry Friedman. We've really had quite a time here with you, chewing over the science headlines.
Thank you. Hope you've enjoyed yourself as well. I did. I know I offered nothing to the show, but thanks for having me.
You alleviated the boredom of our listeners at every turn. I think we just at the point where we were boring our listeners, you jumped in to.
And help I could bore them, is what you're saying. Yeah. So
it was a fun time, as always.
All right. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a sciencey person of note. This week's quote comes from Martin Gardner, a mathematician and popular science writer. In this quote, he is addressing the legacy of Lysenko, a 20th century Russian, I'm going to put geneticist in quotes here, who insisted on anti-Mendelian theories because those ideas matched his political ideology. Biologists who disagreed with him were purged. Plant breeding and agriculture were set back decades, and the results contributed to 20th century famines in the USSR. Martin Gardner said about Lysenko, "Let us hope that Lysenko's success in Russia will serve for many generations to come as another reminder to the world of how quickly and easily a science can be corrupted when ignorant political leaders deem themselves competent to arbitrate scientific disputes." Martin Gardner. With these wise words, we leave you, dear listener, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakityscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.